probably heard about how important independent or moderate or undecided voters are to winning any election. The common wisdom is that to appeal to those voters, candidates should adopt more centrist viewpoints. But our next guest says that's not exactly true. He broke down the numbers for each group and found that their stances are a lot more complex than they're given credit for. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow in the political reform program at the think tank New America. He's the author of the upcoming book, Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. His recent piece for 538 is called The Moderate Middle is a Myth. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Rob.
Before we dig into the data you use to break this down, let's talk about this concept. There's this big group of people in the middle. They're to the right of the Democrats, to the left of the Republicans. Each party has to kind of triangulate to bring them over to their side. When you start digging, you find not so much?
Not so much. Certainly, there are a lot of voters who identify as moderates. Certainly, there are a lot of voters who identify as independents. But when you look at polling and see where they actually stand on issues, you find that they're kind of all over the place, and they're not at all concentrated in the political middle.
And a lot of times we see either party try to win over these alleged centrists, or we even see like Michael Bloomberg or the Starbucks guy Howard Schultz or other people say, I'm going to run a centrist campaign to appeal to this big group in the middle. This idea does seem to drive some people in politics, right?
It does, although, as you may have noticed with Howard Schultz's aborted candidacy, there was not much demand for that, as it turns out. Actually, it turns out what we've seen in American politics over the last few decades is that neither party has actually really tried to go after the political middle, especially the Republican Party, which has moved quite far to the right. So although there's this sort of conventional wisdom that parties need to move to the middle, we actually haven't seen political parties and political candidates doing all that much of it over the last few decades.
And you took each of these terms, the moderate, the independents, and the undecideds, and you tried to break down where they fall ideologically. Can you tell us what kind of data you looked like and what you used as a lens to see what they actually are thinking?
Yeah, so the data that I used comes from the Voter Study Group, which is a consortium of researchers who we've done some polling. It's supported by the Democracy Fund, which is a foundation, and put together an index of economic questions and immigration questions, given that those are two particularly salient issues in our politics, and just plotted everybody on a left-right spectrum, and created a two-dimensional scatter plot of the electorate. And what I found was that they kind of come from all over the electorate, although there are not very many voters who are pro-immigration and pro-leaving things up to the market. So there's not many libertarian voters in the electorate.
So let's break down each word now. We use sometimes independent, moderate, or undecided a little bit interchangeably, but you found different things when you plugged in each term. Let's start with the independents. Now, these are people who said, yeah, I'm an independent. They're self-declared in a way. How did they fall? What was the range of perspective on the economic and the immigration viewpoints?
Yeah, so they're all over the map. And, you know, all of these groups are kind of all over the map on these issues, right? So the conventional wisdom is that they're all kind of in the center. But in reality, some of them are quite liberal. Some of them are quite conservative on economics. Some of them are quite liberal on immigration. Some of them are quite conservative on immigration. Some of them are quite liberal on economics, but conservative on immigration. So there's really no single policy position that can win over independents. I mean, you know that campaigns are always talking about, well, we need to win over independents. Pundits are always talking about, we need to win over independents. And then, you know, pundits will say, well, and if you adopt my preferred policies, then surely you will win over independents. But there's no single unified independent voter, right? They're all, so you could appeal to some independents, but then you'll lose other independents if you're in. So that makes it kind of maddening, but that's, you know, politics.
Talking to Lee Drutman from the think tank New America, he wrote a piece at 538 about myths about moderate, independent, and undecided voters. I want to throw a couple Facebook comments from the Ideas Network Facebook page into this. PJ writes, both parties are too extreme. For example, the left is very open about firearm confiscation, which makes me not want to vote for them. The right, PJ says, wants to limit a woman's right to choose, which makes me not want to vote for them. And Scott writes, I consider myself a libertarian, strongly left on some issues, strongly right on others. Since I have two choices, I pretty much split my vote evenly between Democrats and Republicans. So the independent isn't necessarily somebody in the middle from those two examples. And from what you looked at, it might be somebody who has opinions that don't match up with the set menu in either party.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of voters who don't quite match up with either party. And, you know, often they have quite strong positions and, you know, on two or three or four different issues. And you know, then they will decide based on what issue they feel most strongly about. I think the two-party system actually does a quite poor job of serving most voters. We are a little bit more complex than just that simple binary. And in fact, that complexity is actually quite healthy for politics. I think one of the reasons that our politics has gone so haywire over the last few decades is that everybody who participates in politics has been forced into this zero-sum binary. And it's really simplified our thinking that the key to democratic stability in a broad sense is being able to engage with multidimensional complexity. And that's why I really do believe that in order to get past this current almost existential impasse in our democracy, we need to open up the party system by enacting electoral reforms that make it easier for third, fourth, fifth, even sixth parties to compete.
The moderate middle is a myth. That's the title of a recent piece from our current guest, Lee Drutman. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself a moderate or independent voter? Do you find yourself undecided, say, coming up the day before a presidential election day? What keeps you from identifying with one of the two major parties? What does moderate mean to you? What does independent mean to you? Do you find one party has something you like here, something you don't like over there? Call 800-642-1234. Do you want more parties in the mix? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Lee Drutman is with us, senior fellow in the political reform program at New America, looking at moderate, independent, and undecided voters. He says there's a lot more complexity than those words might hint at. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us if you consider yourself a moderate or independent voter and what that means to you. Lee, we talked about the independents. Let's talk about moderates. I mean, the word sounds like, okay, these are the people in the middle. They have moderation. They don't go too far to either side. What did you find when you plugged in the numbers there?
Well, the moderates are all over the place, although they do tend to cluster a bit more on the center left than other groups. Now, there's probably a good reason for that, which is that a lot of Democratic voters have decided not to call themselves liberals because the label liberal has been tarnished over the years and somewhat. Only somewhat recently have a lot of folks with views on the left decided that it's okay to call themselves a liberal. But the standard survey question is, are you a liberal, a moderate, or a conservative? So if you're not a liberal, you're not a conservative, then you're a moderate. And, you know, frankly, it's like a nice thing to call yourself. I mean, moderation is a virtue, right? So people like calling themselves moderate. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they have moderate centrist policy views, but it may also mean that they think of themselves as having a moderate temperament, that they're just reasonable people. But that we shouldn't confuse that for political stances that are in the middle of the distribution.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sid is with us in Milwaukee. Sid, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I think it's important that we, first of all, make sure that we don't get caught up into just two parties. I think the Democrats and the Republicans have caused a lot of problems. I'm an independent. I used to be a lobbyist, and I noticed how some elected officials, they would just jump party lines whenever it was convenient for them. So we really can't get caught up into the party and really into the individual, what they're about, what their stances are on the issues that I'm concerned about. So we really need to get some more parties out there. You know, we just can't make it Democratic or Republican. We need to get some more options.
Sid, thanks for the call. I have a hunch we'll be calling you, Lee, to talk about your book when it comes out. But if you could spoil it a little, how do we get there from here, from mainly just two parties to one, five more? I don't know.
Well, the reason that we have two parties is not because Americans want only two parties. About two-thirds of Americans, in fact, agree with you, Sid, that we should have more than two parties. But we only have two parties because we have a winner-take-all single-member district electoral system. And given that, it's very hard for third parties to compete because they're treated as spoilers and they wind up the home of cranks and fringe views, and all the energy goes into one of the two major parties. Now, the first past the post single winner plurality system, it's really a quite antiquated system. It was a 1430 innovation. U.S. is one of only a few countries that still uses it. Most advanced democracies have moved to various forms of proportional representation, and there are a lot out there. The system that I think would work best in the U.S., given our political history, is a system that that the Irish have used for over 100 years. It's multi-member districts with ranked choice voting. So instead of having a single representative per district, you combine. I would say five would probably be the ideal, but it could vary. Five representatives into one district, and then the top five finishers represent that district in the legislature. And adding in ranked choice voting, I think, has a number of advantages, that it makes it easier for more candidates to compete and for voters to express the full range of their preferences. And it, you know, ranked choice voting, which has been used in Ireland and Australia for both countries for about 100 years, has a strong tendency to encourage coalition building, and just engages voters in a way that they can express a full preference and vote for candidates who they may prefer, but who may not be likely to make it to win elections, and then they can have backup votes. So I think that would be the system that would work well. There are a variety of options out there, but the main takeaway is that the reason that we have only two parties is not because Americans want only two parties, is that we have an electoral system that makes it very hard for third, fourth, fifth parties to get a foothold.
Sid, thanks for that call. Lee, in our last minute and a half or so, I wanted to ask about the undecided voters. As a media guy, I picture somebody carefully weighing all their options, delving into all the information that's out there. What do we find when we actually look at undecided voters?
Undecided voters are all over the electoral map. Undecided voters also tend to be kind of the least politically engaged and the least predictable. Most people who pay close attention to politics tend to have a team and tend to be on that team. There are certainly a few undecided voters who are in the middle and who are carefully weighing the two options, but most undecided voters are going to choose somewhat randomly on atmospherics or last minute news. So there's not really any clear policy position that's going to win over undecided voters.
So the message to politicians is, if you think you're reaching out to this massive untapped centrist vote, what should they do?
They should reevaluate their strategy, I think.
We'll leave it there. Lee, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, great to be with you, Rob.
That's Lee Drutman, senior fellow in the political reform program at the think tank New America. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Breaking the Two-Party Doom Loop, The Case for Multi-Party Democracy in America. He helped us break down the complexity of moderate, independent, and undecided voters. And there's still time for you to weigh in. If you consider yourself an independent voter What does that mean to you? How do you shape your voting decisions as an independent? If you consider yourself a moderate, how about you? What does moderate mean in practice? If you find yourself undecided come Election Day eves, what is it that makes the final decision for you? You can join the conversation over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or let us know on Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Some of the country's most profound health care challenges are playing out in rural areas that are struggling with populations that are relatively older and relatively sicker. In part three of a five-part series, reporter Mark Zdedlik of Minnesota Public Radio has the story of one rural hospital that's become accustomed to functioning in the red.
Not since 2006 has the Big Fork Valley Hospital taken in more money than it's spent on care. Despite the nonstop financial losses, it continues on.
I'll open the door for you.
Big Fork Valley Hospital CEO Aaron Saudi took me inside a relatively new memory care wing called Aspen Circle.
I love you.
Frank Sinatra wafts from a CD player.
This is a secure unit.
It feels like a homey lodge, open and airy.
A resident wants to wander. Can do that endlessly without hitting the end of a hallway and getting kind of confused.
Located in a remote area of northern Minnesota, Big Fork, population 445, is the smallest town in the state with a hospital. Operating in the red has been a way of life here. Opposite the memory care unit, the emergency room sits idle, but it's staffed up and ready. Saudi says the ER is not a moneymaker, but is a critical Big Fork Valley Hospital service.
So important for our community and then also for tourists, you know, when they get a fish hook in their hand or have chest pains.
The closest hospital is more than 40 miles away. Getting there, especially in the depths of winter, can be a harrowing trip. Dr. George Rounds says if the Big Fork Hospital ever shut down, some critically ill people might not survive the ride.
There is a thing called the golden hour. If you don't get to the hospital within that golden hour, your chances of survival are significantly less.
Newly published research from the University of Washington indicates there's a significant increase in the death rate for time-sensitive health problems in rural areas after a hospital serving the region has closed. Big Fork Valley Hospital is owned by a special unit of government called a hospital district. It has taxing authority throughout a 1,500-square-mile region because more than a dozen local governments agreed to join the district. Dr. Rounds retired after nearly 40 years at the hospital. He now chairs the district's board and has a front-row view of the ongoing financial struggles.
We'll keep limping along as long as we can.
Rural hospitals face unique challenges. They serve disproportionately older, sicker populations than their metro area counterparts. Patients are less likely to have insurance that covers the cost of care. The Minnesota Hospital Association says more than one in four Minnesota hospitals lose money on operations, most of them in rural parts of the state. Healthcare consultant Dan Zismer says financial pressures are forcing independent rural hospitals to join hospital systems with deeper pockets to stay open. That often leads to the elimination of local services, aside from some outpatient and emergency care.
Is healthcare going to go away from rural America? No, but it's probably going to continue to change pretty dramatically.
Like other remote hospitals, Big Fork Valley gets somewhat more generous payments from Medicare, but Round says they still lose money on Medicare patients.
Like if we bill $300 and they will allow $150.
The hospital doubled its levy effective this year, but it is not enough. Round says the area can't sustain a tax increase large enough to make up for all of the losses. Big Forks Hospital is able to keep its doors open amid the losses by spending money intended for maintenance and equipment. With more than 200 people on its payroll, Big Fork Valley Hospital is the biggest employer in town. It is also a prized asset here. 71-year-old Mike Koshin's family has owned the grocery store in Big Fork all his life.
We just love our hospital. We think so highly of our doctors. We're so proud of our facility.
Koshin says if the hospital shuts down, it would trigger a downward spiral for the local economy.
It's a tremendous asset to not only Big Fork, but all the surrounding communities.
Big Fork Valley Hospital CEO Aaron Saudi says the status quo is not sustainable.
We need to do something to turn it around because within 5 years, we could be in trouble.
Saudi says a hospital may have to surrender its independence and join a larger system. Given the demographic and economic trends challenging independent rural hospitals, affiliation may be the best option for many. Mark Zedeklik, NPR News, Big Fork, Minnesota.
Tomorrow, our series continues with a look at a University of Missouri program that immerses future doctors, nurses, and pharmacists in rural communities. These reports are part of a collaboration of 12 newsrooms that includes Wisconsin Public Radio. It's led by Iowa Watch and the Institute for Nonprofit News, with additional support from the Solutions Journalism Network. For more, you can visit hospitals.iowawatch.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a primary here, a caucus there, party members only here, anybody votes over there. We'll find out why the American presidential nomination process is such a mix-and-match patchwork of voting systems from one state to the next. There have been efforts to bring high-speed internet to rural areas in Wisconsin and elsewhere, but a guest tells us there are a lot of internet deserts in urban places, too. We'll look at impeachment, the history of, and why the lessons from past impeachments may not apply today. Historian David Greenberg joins the show for a look at what's similar and what is very different about the current impeachment inquiry and the efforts against Bill Clinton, Richard Nixon, and Andrew Johnson. And he's retired, but he's not done with music. Former UW-Madison marching band director Mike Lecrone joins the show for a look at the big band era. He's teaching a class on it, plus the most memorable songs, performers, and band leaders. You can share your favorites right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.